got in Islamabad, the plane came in about noon. They took me right to the hotel. I freshened up a little bit, and I went right to a material shop. And I picked out this, which is a rather heavy material for wearing in the mountains, and a very lightweight one, which I wore when I was in the city. It was over 100 degrees. I was measured by the tailor, went back the next morning, not quite $25, I had two complete outfits. Now, I was at a book club some time ago, and one of the women said, "Who made your outfit?" And I said, "A tailor." And she said, "Was the tailor a man?" Well, yes, the tailor was a man. And she said, "In that society, can a man measure a woman who is not his relative?" So when I talked to Greg, I said, "Greg, who made my shalwar kameez?" And he said, "A lady tailor." And I said, "No, it wasn't a lady." He said, "He was a lady tailor. He was a tailor. He was married. He was in good standing in the community. He attended Friday services. He prayed regularly. He fasted during Ramadan. So he went to the imam of his mosque, who wrote him a letter of recommendation. He took it to the government, and he became a lady tailor."
So he could measure ladies.
He could measure ladies. Now, I always tell people, none of you know anything about the morals of the people who made your clothing, but mine was made by a very upstanding man.
And he measured you. It wasn't a woman, right?
No, a woman didn't measure me. He measured me.
Well, three cups of tea. How many of you have read the book?
Well, quite a few of you. It came out a little over 4 years ago. And just before the book was published, Greg and David Rellin, the co-author, went to New York. And for the first time, Greg got to see the cover. And he was delighted with the way they put the three little girls there. And he said, "The cups of tea looks a little bit like the Urdu script, but it was one man's mission to fight terrorism, one school at a time." And Greg said, "I don't want that. I'm not here to fight terrorism. That's based in fear. I'm promoting peace and literacy, and that's based in hope." And the publisher said, "Greg, there's something you need to learn about the publishing business. For a book like this, nonfiction, authors don't choose the title, and we even let you choose three cups of tea. Editors don't choose the book titles. Book titles are chosen by the marketing department. And our marketing department feels what's going to sell this book is fighting terrorism." Well, Greg realized there was nothing he could really do about it. But he told me I didn't grow up in Africa, work in Pakistan, and have a German-Danish heritage for nothing. And I said, "If this book ever comes out in paperback, I want the title changed to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace." And they agreed. And he said they probably agreed because the publishers thought, "This book is never going to sell. It will never come out in paperback." The first chapter starts with failure. And Americans are never going to buy a book where the first chapter, the title of it, is failure. Well, the book sold, 30, 40,000 books. And it was good enough that it did come out in paperback a little over 3 years ago now. It has been on the New York Times top 10 nonfiction bestseller list ever since. The last I looked, 162 weeks. It has sold over 4 million books and has been published in 34 different countries. But what I really like is they just did a second edition of the hardcover. And guess what the subject is? One Man's Mission
to promote peace. We need to have hope.
Yes.
We don't need to live in fear.
Well, Greg's story started in Africa. He was 3 months old when we went to Africa. He was 13 when we came back. And when he was 12, the only thing he wanted to do for his 12th birthday was to climb Kilimanjaro. We lived right in the lower slopes. I don't know why they made the house to face the other way, but if you went out the back door and looked up, you could see the mountain. At that time, 12-year-olds didn't climb the mountain. But the porter said, well, he's living here, we know the family, we'll take him up. And his dad thought it was a great idea. I thought, they're not letting other mothers' 12-year-olds climb, I don't know why mine should. But he did go, and he did get to the top. He admits he had a headache, he was vomiting, and the porters kind of pushed him the last 1,000 feet or so. But he said, the view of the world from the top of the world is something to behold, and he got hooked on mountain climbing. Well, years later, he joined an expedition going to K2. The Karakoram Mountains in northern Pakistan, and they go over into China a bit. The largest concentration of high peaks in the world, and the highest of those is K2. Mount Everest is higher, but it's an easier mountain to climb. K2 has very unpredictable weather, and there's more technical climbing. And my youngest daughter, Greg's sister, had died when she was 23. She had severe epilepsy, and one time when she was having a seizure, her heart stopped. And she had an amber necklace, and he was going to leave that amber necklace on the top of K2 as sort of a memorial to her. Well, he didn't make it to the top. One of the men got very ill, and he had to be, his feet froze. He wasn't melting enough snow, drinking enough water. He got seriously dehydrated. His feet turned black. And if they would have left him and gone only a couple thousand feet more, but it would have taken a day or longer, Etienne would have died. So Greg and Scott Darcy, who's from Alaska, the two of them carried him 2 days and nights to where he could be rescued. And then Scott and Greg continued down the mountain and somehow got separated. And they'd been on the mountain a long time. Greg had run low of fuel for melting snow, of food, and he was ill, he was disoriented. They got separated, and here he was wandering around on K2, not really knowing where he was, and he met Musafar. Musafar is about this tall. He is the strongest man I've ever met, and he's always smiling. He's got a 70-pound pack on his back right there. And when he met Greg, he took Greg's tent, his sleeping bag, his cooking things. Greg was left with a couple power bars. That was about all, I think. And Greg was going so slow. And Musafar said, I'll go on down and pitch tent, make camp, have something hot for you to eat, and when you come, we'll eat and then we'll sleep. And Greg got lost again. And now he's wandering around on this mountain without his sleeping bag, without his tent, without his utensils. I do have to tell you, I did meet Musafar, and he was so happy to meet me, Greg's mother. He hugged me, and I don't think I breathed again the rest of the week. Well, as Greg was going, he stumbled into a village, and this is the village of Corfe. They took marvelous care of him. He got the best blanket in the village, which had been part of a dowry of one of the young women. Some of the men who'd been porters knew about massage. He was massaged. He got not only hot tea, he got eggs. And in this, they have chickens, and the men get eggs. The women, maybe one or two a year, and the children, not at all. But he got eggs, one or two every day. And he did get better. In about 10 days, he noticed the children were going somewhere, and he asked, where are they going? Well, they were going to school. And then he asked, could he see the school? And they were quite embarrassed, but they took him to this open field. Were 84 children, 5 girls and 79 boys were sitting with sticks, scratching out their multiplication tables. And there was no teacher. A teacher in Corfe Village cost $1 a day, and the whole village could only scrape together $3 a week. So Master Hussein came 3 days a week, and the other days he taught in another village. Well, then Greg said, well, what do you do in the winter time? They have snow, it's cold, they have harsh winters. And they said, well, they had a winter school, and this was it. No glass on the window, and that open doorway, they hung a heavy, heavy wool blanket.
Is that like a cave?
Actually, it's built up, but in a way it was like a cave because they dug down and had dirt on the floor because a dirt would be a lot warmer than sitting on stone. And this is what it looked like inside. They sat close together, but a couple of hours would be as long as they could be there. And then he made that rash promise, I will build you a school. And he came back to the United States. He was working in San Francisco at the time, at San Francisco General Hospital. Greg's a nurse. He was working in the emergency room. And he sold all his climbing equipment. He sold his books. He reads all the time. That was hard to do. He gave up his apartment. This was unknown to me. He was living in his car. I maybe could have figured it out when his post office, when his address went to a P.O. box, but I didn't really think of that. He was living in his car. Didn't have nearly enough money. So he went to the library and got the addresses of 580 celebrities, sports heroes, as Greg says, you know, dear Oprah, dear Sylvester Stallone, dear Michael Jordan. He wrote 580 letters, and he typed them. He was computer illiterate at the time, and didn't get any replies. Then at Christmas time, he got a letter back from Tom Brokaw, who had also graduated from the University of South Dakota. And Tom Brokaw sent $100 and wished him all the best. Later, when he wrote Three Cups of Tea, he wrote to Tom Brokaw again, and Tom got a copy to read, and he wrote the blurb in the back of the book recommending it. Well, Tom lives in Livingston, or has a ranch near Livingston, Montana, near Bozeman, where Greg lives, and they had dinner together. And Tom told Greg, you know, everywhere I go now, people are asking me about Three Cups of Tea. Television studios, airports, newspaper offices. And he said, you wouldn't believe the hard time my kids are giving me that I only sent $100. And now everybody in the United States knows about it. Well, Greg assured Tom Brokaw that the blurb he wrote was priceless. But what he didn't tell him, and I think is just really amusing, Central Asia Institute gets quite a few donations for $101, and down in the corner will say more than Tom Brokaw. Well, even with what he had sold and Tom Brokaw's $100, he had about $2,000, and it was going to cost $12 to build this school. He came to River Falls, where I was principal, and not even thinking of money, but we wanted the kids to know, what about children in other parts of the world? And he had,
at that time, he had a slide projector that was falling apart. He had it all taped up. But he showed pictures of children in Pakistan. For a couple of days, he went to all the classes. And at the end of the second day, one boy in fourth grade, Jeffrey, came and said, I've got a piggy bank at home. I'm going to bring it so you can build the school. And then the student council met and they said, we are going to sponsor a fund drive. And the faculty met. And one wise first grade teacher said, let's have this be only pennies. If it's only pennies, the poorest child in school will be able to be a part of it as much as everyone else. And we were in a school where we had quite a range of socioeconomic, and that's what absolutely what happened. Everybody, I tell you, there was not a penny on the sidewalk in River Falls, or under a cushion, or grandma and grandpa's, their pennies were all gone. Well, Greg had forgotten about it. And the fund drive was for 6 weeks. The children counted the pennies, and at the end of the 6 weeks, they had gotten 68,345 pennies. That $623.45 was the largest check Greg had ever gotten from anyone up until that time. And with that, we had pennies for Pakistan, but with that, some other schools heard about it. The school got an award from the state of Wisconsin teachers for this. Other people heard about it. And more schools started, and it became Pennies for Peace. Now, when this started, I really thought about how far the money would go in Pakistan and Afghanistan. A penny will buy a pencil. It goes a long ways. $600 is the salary for a beginning teacher for a year. So my emphasis was on that, but more and more, as I have been in schools, I'm seeing what it does for children here. I was in Grand Marais, Minnesota, talking to someone who had been there. And when I was done talking, a little kindergarten guy, a little six-year-old, came up to me and said, I didn't have a penny. So I took my dollar to the bank and bought some. And then he asked me, was that cheating? And I assured him, no, it wasn't cheating. And he said, well, what are they going to do with my 100 pennies? And I asked him, what would you like them to do? And he said, I would like them to buy 100 pencils. So 100 kids can write. And right there I saw how empowered this child was. There was a school in Colorado, I think it was Fort Collins, that they really collected a lot. And somewhere along the line they lost track of how many pennies. They had an idea, but not exactly. And the fund drive was over. They were going to take the money to the bank, and the bank said, we just can't handle these many pennies at one time. You'll have to bring them in a few at a time and put them through the counter, coin counter. Well, the kids were incensed. They wrote a letter to the editor how they had collected all this money for children so they could go to school in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and the bank wouldn't even take it. The school got calls from three other banks, and one bank said, we'll send our armored car over to you. You can guess which bank that school district is working with now. Pennies for Peace is spread all over the world. It was on six continents. And Greg recently spoke in Colorado, and he was saying how this program is spread. It was on six continents. And there was a woman there who was being deployed to Antarctica. So when she got to Antarctica, she wrote a check for Pennies for Peace so he could say it's on seven continents. Well,
still not enough money with the $624, but then John Herney, one of the inventors of the microchip, who had climbed in the Karakorums, heard about what Greg was doing, and he called him up. He said, how much money do you need? And Greg said, well, I'm going to need about $12,000 for the school, and I've got to. I'll send you a check, but don't mess up. And he got a check and was able to have the money to build a school. And he went back to Pakistan. You can see he loaded things there on the truck. Trucks and buses in Pakistan are something to see. And the more beautiful they are, the more business they'll have. So they're all painted like that, and they repaint too. Loaded the supplies and went up the Karakoram Highway. This is the Karakoram Highway. Now, I wasn't expecting, you know, I-90 or anything like that, but highway? There really isn't room to pass. When we lived in Africa, there was a custom on narrow roads like that the car, bus, or truck coming down would find a place to pull aside, and the one going up could continue. In Pakistan, they played chicken. And they'll come, and it'll be like this, and the drivers get out, and they, I don't know if I'd say they're arguing, but they talk and talk and talk until finally somebody will back up, find a place to pull aside, and the other truck can go on. The road gets even narrower afterwards. So the plan was to unload the things in Skardu and then bring it up the rest of the way on jeeps. Well, Greg went back to Corfe and said they had the thing and they were going to load it on the jeeps, and Haji Ali, the headmaster or the head of that village, said, Greg, we have to have a bridge if you're going to bring that. Can you see way up in the right hand corner there, a cable? Mm-hmm. On that cable was a box and a pulley, and one person could go across at a time. There absolutely was no way to bring all that lumber unless they would go to the nearest bridge, which was a half a day away, and then they'd have to walk all that way. He said, first we need a bridge. So Greg came back to the United States, raised money again, and they built this bridge. Now, I didn't understand about the highway, and when I heard about the bridge, I was even expecting a bridge like they have here.
Yeah.
Not something like this, it goes like this. I couldn't look down. I saw this raging river. If I looked up, I saw that big cliff I was going to have to climb. Couldn't close my eyes, so I kept my eye right on that doorway. And I did make it across, and I did climb up that steep cliff. And when I got to the top, I thought, well, I could live in Corfe the rest of my life. Well, the bridge was built. So now it's time to load the things onto the jeeps, bring it up, and the road washed out 18 miles away. Now, Greg said, what are we going to do? And Haji Ali told him, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. And one morning, he heard the boys in the village shouting. And here the men in the village had walked in the dark the 18 miles, and they'd loaded the lumber on their back. And at the front is the village imam. Now, well, for all of you here, you pastors don't listen to this at all, and the rest of you don't tell your pastors. In that area, the imam, the head religious person, does no physical work. Someone else digs their irrigation canal. Someone else takes care of their fields. He was so excited and so supportive that they were going to have a school. He led the procession. And what's really remarkable, he had polio as a child, and he even walked with difficulty. But here he is.
So they walked 18 miles out and 18 miles back.
36 miles. Mm. 36 miles. That day.
And they had to make many trips.
Carrying stuff.
And they had to get that lumber across that bridge.
Well, they had the bridge to do it. And one of the things Greg had never, ever thought of, and I always think of it when I think of bridges. In that society, a woman marries into her husband's family. In Corfe, the only way you could get across the river was to walk over a half a day. And there was no way then that the women could go visit their families, because they would have to be gone overnight, and that couldn't be done in that society. The bridge was built. On Friday afternoons now, you see this big procession of women and children going to visit family. It has kept them from the isolation that they have, and it's allowed them to stay close to their own families. Well, anyway, they got the material there, everyone was working, the men were laying the stone, the boys were bringing the little stones that they were putting in for chinking, and because the men were working full time with the stones, they blast in the mountain and then they chip the stones so they're somewhat a square size. So the women were taking over the irrigation canal, some of the things the men usually did. The grandmothers were going back to doing the cooking, and the old men, who didn't usually do a whole lot more than spinning some wool and sitting around talking, the old men started taking care of the children. So everyone was working, and Greg was the construction foreman. Now, Greg has never built anything in his life, and I was really surprised. You know, he had his plumb line, and he had a little account book. He was keeping track of every rupee, because he knew children had brought pennies, and some people had sacrificed to give. And it was going really slowly. Some days, people wouldn't be there, and Greg would be wondering what had happened to them. And Haji Ali, the village head man there, called Greg aside one day and he said, "Greg, we are so appreciative and we are so happy we are having a school, but you are driving us crazy." And he asked, "Will you do us a favor?" And Greg said, "Well, he'd do anything." And he said, "Will you sit down and shut up?" And he took everything he had, locked it into his little locker, and sat there. And Greg was banished from the construction site. So here you have a village where everyone is working except Greg. So he decided he'd teach some English. So he went down to this open field, and one of the first things he taught them was Mary Had a Little Lamb. Very culturally appropriate. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is mentioned more often in the Quran than in the Bible. And Miriam is a very common name throughout the Islamic world. And of course the children knew about lambs. They raised sheep and goats there. And they did think it hilariously funny that the lamb would go down the hill to the school where there wasn't any grass at all, rather than up the hill to where the green grass grew. Well, Greg got out of the way. 6 weeks later, the school was done. He said his first lesson was the three cups of tea. When he was there in the village, Haji Ali told him when he banished him, "You know, here you have to have three cups of tea. With the first cup, you're a stranger. The second cup, you're an honored guest or a friend. With the third cup, you're family. And for family, we would do anything, even die." And Greg learned that you have to take the time to build the relationships. I learned that on 9/12, the day after 9/11. Suleiman, his driver, called me from Pakistan. And at that time, Suleiman was still running his taxi business, and it must have cost him a whole month's profit in taxi fares to call me. But he called me and he said, "Don't worry about your son. We have heard what happened in the village of New York. Don't worry about him. I am his brother, and I will protect him with my life." Well, as it turned out, there weren't riots, there wasn't trouble in Pakistan, but he wanted to assure me. So Greg said that was the first lesson he learned. And the second lesson he learned is, don't be there to do something for them, to give them something, to tell them what to do. Let them do what they can. And I think that's one reason Habitat for Humanity has been so successful. They don't build a house for someone and move in. They have to have sweat equity in it also. And are you going to help me set up so I can play the... Okay, so we'll set up so I can show you a DVD. And I'm going to stop here with the first school. It took 3 years for the first school. In the 14 years since then, they've built 142. They're building 20 more in Afghanistan right now, and 6 more in Pakistan. In Pakistan, they aren't concentrating so much on the schools as scholarships, because as people finish in these schools, they can go on to some higher education.
Do you have that DVD?
Yeah, it's in there.
Do you want to just let them walk up, or do you want to do that?
We've been doing that on the laptop.
Right.
Well, he's getting me straightened out here. Do you have questions?
I was wondering if some of the CAI schools are ones that have been blown up.
There was one that was threatened, and that's the one I want to show you. Here, if we get things working, and the villagers more or less drove the Taliban out.
Flooding now, is there, are some of the...
Flooding, in Pakistan, the Central Asia Institute schools are mostly in the mountains. There is one in the Punjab, and that village has been flooded, but the schools were up higher.
At what point, Greg, was, I think, working with the administration, advising them, the president, on policy? Is he still doing that?
Well, he isn't really working with the president, but he, well, let me back up a little bit. I was invited to speak to a coalition of peace churches in Minneapolis. And then someone called and uninvited me. They said there were some people who didn't want me to come because they heard that Greg was consulting with the military. And I said, no, the military is consulting with Greg. Uh-huh. And so the next day they called me and they invited me back again.
Well, he didn't take any federal money just because of that.
He doesn't take any federal money. He doesn't take any military money. The government had offered to launder the money through the Philippines for him. But he said, no, he doesn't want to do that. General Petraeus, General McMillan, Colonel Kalenda, Admiral Mullen have all read Three Cups of Tea. All of them, their wives gave him the book and said, this is a book you need to read. But he really feels that Greg's a pacifist. He was in the service, but he's become a pacifist. But he really believes the military is ahead of our government. as far as building relationships with the people. The one thing that really bothers him, and the one mistake he thinks we're really making, is the drones. Mm-hmm. That the Taliban see it as cowardly to start with, and civilians are killed. Are we getting it?
I'm working on it. You may just switch it over to the DVD player if you want me to make it.
Okay. Any other questions? I don't know, it's worked just fine all last week.
Yeah, we're switching to the DVD player.
You said that.
Will this work for you?
That Greg uses about Taliban threatening schools. You said that there was one. I the village sort of resisted their threats. I think that that's another advantage of the sweat equity being in the schools, is that the village is totally invested.
Absolutely. So they've given the land, they've put in all this labor, it's theirs. It isn't the Central Asia Institute school in Corfe or Lalander, it's the Lalander school. And that makes a big difference, I think. Now I need to go to, I think, 19. Now I need to fast forward here.
Yeah.
They are just children, and they are the prize in a fierce competition.
More volume?
Yeah, I was just turning it down for a little bit while I'm figuring out where we are. How far do we have to go? It said 19.
No, back just. Still a little more. Now the other way. No. Go back a little.
Back a little?
Yeah.
Do I take a draw?
No, the other way.
So we're at 17 minutes right now.
15 years ago, this
there. That's good.
World's second highest peak, Pakistan's treacherous K2. But he failed, stumbling down the mountain, starving, sick, and exhausted.
Yeah.
He was nursed back to health in a remote village in the foothills.
One day, I walked behind the village and saw 84 children sitting in the dirt during their school lessons. Most of them were riding with sticks in the sand. And it was that a very rash moment they asked for help to build a school. This is in September 93. I said, I'll promise to build a school for you.
And did you?
I built a school and then 78 more and still doing it today.
Bob and Jen are old friends.
Working with local villagers, Greg's Central Asia Institute now educates 13,000 students, mostly girls, in places where outsiders dare not venture.
Our primary area of focus is in areas where there are no schools or there's no girls going to school, and that's usually because of conflict, religious extremism, or areas of very remote physical isolation.
Places like Lalander Village, last stop on today's very rough journey.
Mm-hmm. What's going on? Can't be blocked, is it? Police are all out. No, it's all right.
Once we get there, Greg finds good friends waiting for him. Like Fazal Ahmed. Before visiting the school,
they have education, they can do it. But without it, they can't do a thing.
His 13-year-old daughter, Saida, studies in this home school that Greg has organized because the Taliban targets public schools for girls.
Saida, do you like learning? Are you glad you're being educated?
Yes, I'm happy to learn so I can have a good future.
What do you want to be?
Doctor.
A doctor. Do you think girls can be future leaders of Afghanistan? Can you be a leader?
Well, what is this? That's where you're
If you're
you're educated, of course.
Why is it so important to educate girls beyond the obvious equality?
When I see girls learning how to read and write, they often teach their mother how to read and write.
Not only does this improve the lives of their family and their community, but Greg has also found that educated women can be a firewall against extremism.
When someone goes on jihad, they first should get permission and blessings from their mother. If they don't, it's very shameful or disgraceful. And I saw that happen after 9/11. They're primarily targeting illiterate, impoverished society because many educated women were refusing to allow their sons to join the Taliban.
The Taliban target schools, and in the last 2 years, 640 have been closed. They tried to do it right here in Lalanda.
About a dozen Taliban came in at night. There were some shots fired, and the next, they said, if anybody comes to school, we're going to kill you. But the community basically got the Taliban out of here.
Greg believes the villagers are willing to fight for their schools because they provide the land and the labor.
The guards here have orders from the commandant that if anybody harms any student or shoots any, just kill them. Don't ask questions.
Really, commandant? It's a shoot to kill order?
Yeah, that would be a shoot.
Yes, absolutely. 100%.
Assalamu alaikum.
This was a day to give Greg a hero's welcome. And to celebrate the feast of Nowruz, the Afghan New Year. Should I sit down? Is that appropriate? I'll sit down here.
Yeah, you can sit there.
Is that funny? Is that funny?
Funny because I was the only woman sitting on the ground with all these men. But despite all the smiles, Greg and the village elders share a serious mission, winning the battle for the next generation. You used to be U.S. military.
I'm a veteran, yes.
Does your sort of civilian effort, how does it contribute to counterinsurgency, or does it?
I talk to any of the commanders here. They'll say that what we need, we don't need guns, we don't need bombs, but what we need is education. Before the school was here, about 60-70% of the boys did go to the extremist madrasa here. Now that's pretty much non-existent.
Guys, what does Dr. Greg mean to you? What has he done for you?
Now we will be educated, and our future will be good.
And what do the teachers think? Do you think because these kids are now in a proper school, will they be friends of America in the future?
Absolutely. All these kids are all studying in the school. Otherwise, they've been studying in a mosque.
It's one more victory in Greg Mortensen's 15-year battle.
Okay, this step is for the teacher.
Next. Soldiers trying to fight a war Greg's way with books and not bombs.
Oh, I'm in the other one. Yeah, I'm on stop now. I'm so glad there's people that know more about technology than I do.
Well, time for two questions. If two people have questions.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard back since the flooding?
What I've heard about the flooding is that none of the CAI schools have been flooded. That one of the villages has been, but the school was up higher. But it really is terrible. And especially in some of the regions where the Taliban was so active, and I think of those children that lived through that, and they're now living through this flooding. One-fifth of the country is underwater. And I don't know what it is in this country if we have fatigue after all the disasters, or it's because it's in an Islamic country, but I just am not hearing that much about it.
A two-part question. First, why are you here? What is your role with the institute or as Greg's mom? And secondly, if you could send out a message with us as to what we can do, what would that message be?
I probably, maybe because of my background in education, maybe because I think there's so much hope with our young children, I probably would say, see if you can start a pennies program someplace, because I see that as really helping there, but also creating empathy and efficacy for our children here. So that would probably be that. And I can tell you where you can get all the DVDs too.
Okay.
So I will end with Assalamu Alaikum, peace be upon you. Thank you very much.